Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined by one of our habitual offenders, repeat offenders here at Emerald Coast Conference, Dr. Randy Sorge. And I got a couple of talks down here. Happy to regather here in Destin, Florida. We're talking, you had one on urgent care, and we'll let that one slide for the moment. But you did do one, some clinical pearls on COPD. So first and foremost, kind of give us a little update, what's been going on, what you're doing, where you're doing, how you're doing it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me, Ryan. It's a pleasure to be back on the podcast. Pleasure to be back here at beautiful Destin, Florida. Still at LSU in New Orleans. I'm an associate program director there now. And, you know, just fighting the good fight down in the Big Easy, so.
All right, so you're talking about COPD, so a super common diagnosis for us, but not one that that we talk too much about pearls, because we just have this assumption that this is the way it's going to go. We're going to do our NEBs. We're going to do our steroids. Yeah, let's do that. Still smoking? Yep. Okay. Expectation. So give us a little breakdown of the talk, the idea, and what you got at today.
Yeah,
tomorrow.
Right, yeah. So, you know, I agree. I don't think COPD sounds like a very exciting topic, but there are some important clinical pearls that I do think, you know, are worthwhile to discuss with emergency physicians about best practices in treatment. And so I tried to focus the lecture just on the most high-yield clinical pearls as far as who needs to be antibios, what types of things like really need to be considered in order to make sure that we're taking care of patients effectively and completely.
Perfect. So we're going to ruin the whole lecture because we're going to do it early. of course, it's going to be released well after you do the talk itself, but walk us through it. Of course, the antibiotics thing is going to be a key discussion point, but give us some of the initial pearls, some of the things that you thought were high impact items for the physicians and others out there when dealing with a COPD patient that presents to us.
Sure. So, you know, the classic teaching as far as like, hey, what defines a COPD exacerbation are the three criteria, you know, that you have some sort of worsening dyspnea, that you have increased frequency of your cough, and that you have some sort of purulent sputum. Well, purulent sputum, meaning that, you know, it's mucoid, it's green, it's brown, actually has no sort of clinical utility as far as helping you determine whether this is a bacterial infection or a viral infection. What makes mucoid sputum so gross is that it's all these dead neutrophils and things that are collecting in the smaller airways and the alveoli that people are chucking up. Although it's one of the criteria for, you know, diagnosing a COPD exacerbation, it doesn't mean that the patients need antibiotics just because they have mucoid sputum. It can still be a viral etiology. So the consistency of the sputum, what patients are telling you they're coughing up, doesn't help you as a physician determine at all whether it's bacterial or viral in nature. And I think that that's just something that we need to clearly state and understand before we start throwing antibiotics at everybody.
So it's just like when your patients bring in the bag of whatever thing that they have, fluid from their insides, whether it's vomit, spit, sputum, poop, whatever it still is as unimportant as I initially thought it would be.
Exactly.
Do you want to see this? I brought it back. No, I absolutely do not want to see that. And then, you know, the whole argument of, well, doctor, it is green now. It is yellow now. Okay, perfect. That's
right. Patients are always impressed by the color change, and they think you will be too. And so I guess my point is, you know, take them at their word, but at the same time, like, don't let that affect your decision to give antibiotics, yes or no, based on the color of the sputum.
You can be empathetic and supportive, but it's
exactly
not what we're going to do about it. All right.
Yeah. Another pearl that I think is important is that when it comes to patients that come into the emergency department with mild COPD exacerbations, patients that you think you can turn around and discharge, there's no good evidence for which one of those patients require antibiotics and which ones don't. It's completely a clinical decision, which is going to be up to you as the clinician and, you know, how the patient looks and feels. So when it comes to discharging patients from the emergency department with a COPD exacerbation, who gets antibiotics and who doesn't get antibiotics, there's no good guidelines on.
That kind of blows.
So, you know, they'll say that, you know, that's a little hard pill to swallow. I'll say that patients that, you know, have history of antibiotic use within 3 months, and then have like failed, meaning they're back again in your emergency department with another COPD exacerbation, maybe those are patients you should consider giving antibiotics to. Patients that have severe comorbidities or what's called frequent exacerbations, by the way, frequent is not defined in the literature. Again, clinically, maybe those patients would benefit from a trial of antibiotics. The flip side of the coin is anybody who's going to be admitted to the hospital for COPD, all of those patients require antibiotics. And kind of the teaching here is that if you're sick enough to be admitted, then you're sick enough to receive antibiotics. So if they're going to come in to the hospital, antibiose them. If they're going to go home after a short course and they look good, they don't have any sort of, you know, their tachypnea is resolved, they don't have supplemental oxygen, they don't have a ton of comorbidities, they're not a frequent flyer here every week, then the decision to give antibiotics, yes or no, is going to be a clinical one up to the provider.
And that's, I guess we had that recent change, wasn't too long ago, that you know, initially COPD, it was not recommended, even though, I mean, Z-Pak, the initial, the universal antibiotic for everything viral. But, you know, with the significant change, so if somebody, whether they have sputum or not, is a productive cough or not, but an acute change in that, is that still a player versus the color? Is that going from one version not productive to productive or significant change, is that still a player in any decision?
I'll say that, you know, having some sort of change in your chronic cough or your sputum production is a criteria in order to make the diagnosis of COPD exacerbation, but it does not guide antibiotic therapy or management.
Seems like more still playing under the acute chronic bronchitis and the wording you got to use for the MIPS anyway. So roll on. What else do we have? What am I going? Do I need to do better or differently with regard to the management of COPD?
So again, we touched on this a little bit about this 3 month period. That's something that's good to keep in mind. So if you're in the, let's say you were here last week, you got your Z-Pak, it didn't help. You're back again with another COPD exacerbation. It's okay to antibiose that person, but don't choose another Z-Pak. If you've had therapy, antibiotic therapy, within the past 3 months, and now you're here back again, you should assume that whatever bacteria you were think you were treating was not susceptible to the initial therapy. So if you gave them a Z-Pak and it didn't work, they're back within 3 months, switch to another antibiotic out of class, meaning give them, you know, levofloxacin, give them Augmentin, but don't give them another Z-Pak. If it's over 3 months, you were here 4 months ago, 6 months ago with a COPD exacerbation, the Z-Pak worked for you, now you're back again 4 months later, it's okay to give them another Z-Pak. So that 3 month window can kind of help guide. If you decide that this patient would benefit from antibiotics, figuring out what they were last on and how long ago will help you guide your antibiotic selection if you deem that it's necessary for that patient.
Now, do you find that like certain times of the year for us in Central Kentucky, you know, in the spring and fall, of course, with the environmental exposures this year, there's just the ragweed is giving the rabbits a run for the reproductive money in terms of how much is out there. Certain times of the year, we have a lot of the environmental triggers that are getting folks going a lot of times. You know, those I see more of that reactive airway disease, environmental exposure. I'm not necessarily hitting with antibiotics. Is there a way that you do that, considerations of the risk, environmental risk, or what maybe we may be seeing going around, you know, especially with COVID, we're seeing a lot of clinics, walk-ins, urgent treatments, automatically hitting people with antibiotics and steroids in those type situations. But, you know, for me, a lot of times, depending on how much I think may just be an environmental exposure, whether horses or grasses or pollens, may be more of a situation where I don't do antibiotics just because I feel like it's more of an external trigger rather than infectious.
You know, that's a really good point and certainly a thought-provoking question. It's really hard to determine, you know, if it's flu season and they're flu positive, do they need antibiotics? Probably not. It all depends on how sick you think they are. Again, let's say they're flu positive, they're here with a COPD exacerbation, you're like, well, they're probably flu is the trigger. There's probably an environmental trigger here that's not a bacterial infection. If they're coming into the hospital, they probably still deserve antibiotics. If they're going home and you think there's another etiology, the other eyes are well appearing and they look well and they don't have an oxygen, you know, they don't have an oxygen requirement, they're not tachypneic, they're not febrile, they're looking comfortable, and you want to send them home, and you feel like there's another etiology other than a bacterial cause for the reason for their exacerbation, again, it's a clinical decision whether to discharge that patient with antibiotics. And there's no good guidelines to support it either way.
Have we had any evolution in the actual management? I know that there's research on high-flow humidified delivery methods for oxygenation, ventilation. Has there been any real change recommendations in terms of how do we manage the respiratory efforts and ventilation of these patients?
No changes, but it's more established now that some sort of positive pressure helps these patients. So whether you're giving them a little bit of positive pressure through high-flow nasal cannula or BiPAP, it is incredibly effective at helping these patients get better, opening up those smaller airways and turning these patients around in your ER. So using some sort of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation is recommended for COPD, and generally the earlier the better.
With these patients, you know, I feel like with the incidence of COVID over the last couple of years, even if folks have recovered, that there's been a little bit more of a long-term burden with COPD, chronic coughs, things of that nature, just with the long COVID, chronic scarring, fibrotic changes, things of that nature, especially of the earlier etiologies or earlier manifestations of COVID-19 because of how much more that had a pulmonary impact with the crazy paving and scarring and multifocal pneumonia type pictures. Are we seeing any evolution, epidemiologic changes with COPD secondary to coming out of a 2.5-3 year pandemic?
It's a really good question. I don't have the data on me about that, but clearly, you know, COVID-19 has thrown us all for a loop and we're all kind of learning as we go. We know that it affects the immune system and can result in long-lasting symptoms, you know, from cytokine production and things like this. So if you're already a patient with chronic COPD and you already have a lot of elevated chronic inflammatory markers and bronchial, you know, small airway type of inflammation, having a secondary insult on top of that, certain, I mean, logic just says, like, it can't make it any better. Probably can only make it worse. And so since it's a progressive chronic disease, I think any additional insult, you know, they already show that any additional exacerbation puts patients at risk for, you know, more morbidity in the future. So I can only imagine that, you know, contracting COVID when you're a COPD patient is just going to lead to poor outcomes for you, for that patient down the road.
All right, for the sake of ruining the entire lecture, you know, we hear these talks are all 30 minutes. Like it's kind of like the perfectly designed emergency medicine conference. All topics are 30 minutes. You start early, then you have the entire afternoon at the beach, and then in the evening there's receptions and that nature. We have a couple of winter conferences that are that way that I attend. Really, those shorter topic aspects for the higher yield aspects. Are there other parts that within your lecture, things that we haven't touched on so far?
Yeah, so you know, we talked a little bit about if they're sick enough to come into the hospital, then they're sick enough to get antibiotics. As a provider, which antibiotics to give them, there's some good guidelines on that. Mm-hmm. So if you think somebody needs to be admitted, well, the one thing you should ask yourself is this patient at risk for Pseudomonas? If they are, give them an antibiotic that covers for Pseudomonas. And so some of your more classic like Pseudomonas risk factors that are good to keep in your back pocket is anybody that has very advanced COPD disease, any of your frequent flyers that come into the hospital frequently are at risk for for Pseudomonas. Anybody who frequently uses antibiotics, you know, they've gotten 8 Z-Packs in the last month and a half, those patients are at risk for Pseudomonas. And anybody that has a prior sputum culture, if you chart check them, that's positive for Pseudomonas, those patients should get Pseudomonas coverage, which means that instead of just giving them something like ceftriaxone, Cefotax, levofloxacin, moxifloxacin, those patients with Pseudomonas risk factors coming into the hospital should be covered with something like cefepime or zosyn.
So going more of that typical broader spectrum, but also make sure you get that Pseudomonas.
Exactly. Some other things that I think were helpful as far as clinical pearls for COPD is, you know, we all know that you don't want to hyperoxygenate the patients. The old teaching, at least though, when I was in medical school, was like, oh, you know, they've got this hypoxic respiratory drive. But that has kind of been disproven as been the underlying pathophysiology. You still want to keep their goal oxygen saturations anywhere between 88 to 92%. But the reason is because of hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction. meaning that the diseased alveoli that aren't doing good gas exchange, the body's natural reaction is to constrict those capillaries and shunt the blood to the good parts of the lung that are doing gas exchange. If you flood that person with oxygen, you end up dilating all of the capillaries in the lung, and now blood is going both to good alveoli and bad alveoli, and you're actually getting worse VQ mismatch. So keeping them, if they're hypoxic, of course, give them oxygen, but with a goal saturation of 88 to 92%, with the purpose of you're optimizing their VQ mismatch and sending as much blood as you can to the good parts of the lung to perform gas exchange and steering the blood away from the diseased alveoli. The only exception to that is a patient, of course, that you think you're going to intubate. Somebody that you're going to intubate should go under nitrogen washout, be put on 100% NRB to, you know, optimize them for intubation. But they're going to be admitted to the hospital. They have an oxygen requirement. You're going to choose high flow. You're going to choose BiPAP, whatever it is. That's fine. But goal oxygen saturation, 88 to 92%.
Well, it makes more sense. I mean, you've got patients that you're trying to send home. We just want to reach that happy balance, that most efficient physiology. Whereas if I'm going to go more invasive airway, I'm trying to really flood everything and overdose the body on everything to buy that amount of time that you need for intubation or that invasive airway. So it completely makes sense. And I'm glad that we're finally over this. And I know we've talked about it before. That we're finally over this whole idea that if I give too much oxygen, get the sats too high on COPD, or I'm going to turn off the brain stem. They're not going to breathe on their own. And
right.
I mean, turn off that respiratory drive. I mean, there's so much that we learned in medical school and residency that has since been debunked. I mean, this whole idea of coming out of med school, and, you know, a lot of times when I do talks for students, especially graduations and stuff, and say, you know, about 50% of what you have learned so far will be malpractice by the time your career's over. And unfortunately, we just don't know which stuff and how long before it's considered malpractice, just because of the evolution of understanding and information and evidence that is out there. There are a lot of things that will stick around, but also a lot of myth and dogma that stick around, you know, whether it's, you know, shutting off the respiratory drive or the epinephrine on the fingers, nose, toes, and hose, and or whatever it may be,
right,
that is out there that was based in good theory and good kind of thoughts on physiology, but didn't play out with regard to actual human beings. Any closing thoughts with regard to the COPD and the management of these patients that I feel like we're seeing at a clipping rate so far in 2022?
Yeah, two last things that I think are important to know is if you're ever admitting the patient and your admitting physician's asking for an ABG, it's largely unnecessary. A VBG, although not as accurate, is generally sufficient for our purposes in the emergency department to at least get a good approximation of the pH and the PCO2. And as long as you're trending those numbers to make sure that the PCO2 is improving and you're improving ventilation, it's largely sufficient for our realm in the emergency department. So these patients, I would say COPD patients as a whole, do not routinely require ABGs. Some indications for an ABG may be patients who are intubated, going to the ICU, or who have ARDS or multi-system organ failure. Those patients, I can see the clinical utility of getting an ABG to calculate an AA gradient and do all the fancy things they're going to do up in the critical care unit. But routinely, COPD patients, even for hypercarbia, don't need routine ABGs. VBGs are sufficient. And the last thing I think that is important to touch on is this new thing about CRP. A lot of our admitting physicians are going to ask for CRP on these patients to kind of help them suss out who's really going to benefit from antibiotics and who's not. This is still an area under active investigation, and it's not ready for prime time in the emergency department, but it is a powerful tool for who, as an admitted patient, can be de-escalated off of antibiotics. And so the way that CRP is being used right now is basically if it's super high, like above 40, those patients probably benefit from antibiotics. If it's super low, like less than 10, those patients probably don't need antibiotics. And anybody else in the middle ground, it's a little bit of a clinical judgment. But again, it's not going to be a test that we're using in the emergency department to decide who needs to be started on antibiotics. How it's being used right now is much more on the inpatient side, as if their CRP remains low, who can be rapidly de-escalated. So again, if you feel like a patient needs antibiotics, it's a clinical judgment. Start them. regardless of what their CRP is. But the admitting physician might trend those numbers over time and then decide, oh, this is probably a patient that we could rapidly de-escalate off antibiotics, and maybe it's COVID, maybe it's flu, maybe it's allergies, maybe it's any other million environmental triggers. And so that's how CRP is currently being used, but it's something good that we should know about because, again, the admitting teams might start asking us to order this on our patients to decide who's best to de-escalate off.
And we're seeing a lot of that research right now. Actually, if for those listening out there, if you listen to our podcast from Emergencies in Medicine from Park City, we talked a significant amount about the research and data on procalcitonin and its future with regard to differentiate viral versus bacterial, with that 0.5 as the cutoff mark. Higher than that, very high likely of bacterial involvement. Below that number is very low likelihood of bacterial involvement. And then CRP as well. And our goal eventually to be more specific and better stewards of our antibiotics that are out there. Because we sit here and we kind of joke around about the little, about the Z-Packs and things, but everybody out there working in the emergency department has just seen this inundation of antibiotics for viral syndromes over the last, forever, but COVID, it seems to have amped it up. If you had a cough, almost everything we saw for 2.5 years was viral. And if you had a cough and it didn't flag positive for COVID, they got an antibiotic. Even if it flagged for COVID, it got worse after 3 days, which every COVID did for almost all cases. They got an antibiotic. Looking at these horizon views of procalcitonin CRPs as potential answers to say, well, really, do they need it? And that may be something that we can use once the more evidence is out there. And then, of course, there's some serum tests that are coming out as well to better differentiate, looking at several components together, looking at that risk of viral versus bacterial. But, for us to be able to say, okay, CRP is low, the procalcitonin is low, very low likelihood of bacterial involvement, being able to treat just symptomatically, relaxing those lungs, getting them the inflammatory process to chill out a little bit. But as you mentioned, it's still more evidence to be had, but goal eventually that we in emergency medicine, but especially looking at places that tend to be very, if it's not an ankle sprain, it's an antibiotic kind of situation, that we may actually be able to reel in some of that stewardship for antibiotics.
Absolutely, and I think that's the goal, is really keeping up with the literature. These things seem to be coming down the pipeline for us and seeing how things change over the next 2, 5, or 10 years so that we can treat our patients better, really give antibiotics to those who need it, and save it for people who don't.
And if you're wanting to check out that podcast on the ProCal discussion with regard to pulmonary illnesses, you're going to be looking for ASAP Frontline with Dr. James Neuenschwander from a few months back, but a great discussion that we had concerning some of that lab work and its role in some of these differentiation, not just COPD related like this particular talk, but related to just pulmonary illnesses in general. How can folks get in touch with you if they have any questions, thoughts, want to reach out?
All right, well, I don't have a Twitter, but you can always email me. I got a Gmail, so it's rm, and then my last name, sorge@gmail.com.
So don't have the Twitter, you held up. Held up.
I'm holding out.
You don't have gray hair, but you held out on Twitter. So I appreciate your time, Dr. Randy Sorge, here at Emerald Coast Conference in Destin, Florida. I appreciate the time again, and giving us a few pearls on COPD.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure, Ryan.
As for me, you can contact me at rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org, or at Everyday Med on Twitter. So I've got Twitter. You can reach out to me, but not Dr. Sorge. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASEP Frontline. Yeah.
If you're not on the front lines, you're on the sidelines.